and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to another edition of The Studcast. And of course, I'm the great Ryan Last, and I'm very pleased to once again introduce to you the host of The Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller.
Good day to you, Brian. Very glad to be here with you, man. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, we have another good show this week. It's almost a continuation of everything from last week, so I'm excited about that. And last week's show, I guess I should at the top of the show here mention, we had some really good questions. And because I'm new here, I didn't know the policies here in the office, and we have to actually pick a winner. And what does this winner get, Ron?
Yeah, the winner gets an autographed photo. I've been sending it each winner of these questions that we do. And I apologize to some fans. There have been some weeks here in which we don't do questions, and usually that means we've got so much content in the program that we've not gotten to the questions. But normally that person that we select as a winner of the question of the week, basically he gets an autographed photo that we send to him free. And just appreciate the fans out there that they get involved with us and jump on that Facebook every once in a while. Now it's not been as often as it was earlier, but probably within the next 3 weeks, I'll be looking for questions again from the fans. And I usually put that on my Facebook site. So you can go to Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, that particular site at Facebook, and leave your questions once you see them there. And I will try to get them out and have them be selected. And it's always a pleasure. The fans ask fabulous questions. I'm always amazed at how great our fans are, Brian, and what their knowledge is of the sport.
Well, the fabulous question from last week that won was sent in by Robbie Stewart in Panama City, Florida. Hopefully not the guy that stabbed you or tried to stab you in Panama City, Ron. But the question was, many may remember this, who were some of your best friends in the wrestling community? That was the question.
Yes, and it was a great question. And Robbie, we apologize for not getting that winner name last week, but you will be receiving your picture soon. And I'll be actually in touch with you. I like to get in touch with those people that win and at least make contact with them. And I just appreciate you sending it, Robbie, and all the others that have sent these questions. And as a matter of fact, you were mentioning to me earlier before we came on the air, Brian, that you really like some of these two today. These are really excellent questions today. So I'm looking forward to it.
I am too, but before we get to the questions, we have to continue the story from where we left off last week with the Studcast.
Yes, and we're going to go back. We've been doing this since I started that. I think it was probably episode 32, in which I actually started in the ring and started my career in Georgia. And we've been opening each one of these last couple of episodes with just some facts that fans probably are pretty, I don't think they have any knowledge of, as to how you really get yourself acclimated to being a professional wrestler. And there's a lot of things involved in it. And we're going to start today with the continuation of that. I talked the first time about the Matt Burns and the little things that that hurt you that you don't think about and the normal fan would never think about. Last week we talked about other aspects of it, the Georgia territory and getting acclimated to making the towns and the televisions and all the things that's necessary as a young wrestler to get acclimated to and to make your life out of, to build your life around. And today I want to talk about more about kind of learning the ropes about how you get the lessons that's necessary to learn to become a fixture in the wrestling and in the sport of wrestling. And so it's pretty basic stuff, but I think fans may find it to be interesting. One of the things that I started in, because I came from a wrestling family, there were certain things that were obvious to me pretty early on, that you can't be late. When you are on a card, and you have the opportunity to go and do your thing and to be a part of such great sport that we were lucky enough to be a part of, is you never wanted to be late. I always wanted to be early, in fact. So I used to leave always a little bit early in case something happened, or just to be there early. I liked the atmosphere of the dressing room. And that's a critical part of every wrestling promotion. When you run a company, as I did, and had my own wrestling companies, my dressing room, I spent time there, and I always paid attention to who was good in the dressing room, who had an upbeat attitude, who was in there joking and making things lighthearted and fun and relaxed, creating that relaxed atmosphere. You don't want to go to the ring when you're all stressed and you're concerned. You want to try to get yourself in a calm state of mind before you go out there to do your thing. And that's pretty difficult as a young guy. It's really difficult because you're so anxious and you're so nervous in all of your matches for the first, I was probably for the first year. Every single match, I like to never got over. I thought I was never going to get past the nervousness that was involved with it. So you want to get that relaxed feeling before you go there. You want to go. There's a certain, I guess it's called etiquette. I'm going to call it dressing room etiquette. Probably a strange way to put it, but there's certain things that's always been done in wrestling, and I noticed it. From the very beginning, even before I started wrestling, I was lucky enough to be able to go in the dressing rooms occasionally after I got to be 16, 17 years old. And I noticed that guys, what they go and introduce themselves, especially to people they don't know. They always say hi to everybody. But if you don't know a guy, you go to the trouble of going and putting your hand out and telling them who you are. And it's like cordiality among wrestlers that's kind of expected. When you do that, you're beginning to show your maturity in the sport. So that was a part of it that was I did not expect that, to see that type of interaction in the dressing room. But it was really important, critical part. I like to watch every match, everybody's match. I mean, the ones before you, the ones after you. Because you learn things in all those matches. You see moves that you had never thought of before. You start as a young wrestler wanting to build your repertoire, build your style. And in order to do that, you had to pick up stuff from other guys. And that was a great help to me to watch matches. And I would see a lot of young guys sitting in the dressing room and not watching. And I always wondered, how are they going to improve if they don't watch and try to not copy, but try to pick up on some moves that they see different guys do? We all in wrestling develop our own style. We can do the same move, but 10 wrestlers are going to do it all a little bit differently. They're never going to be perfectly the same. So you can steal things. Let's say I'll call it stealing it. You can steal some moves from people and create, it will come out as your own move in a way. And that helps you to develop what's most important, to become a star. And that takes years. I don't think we've mentioned that, Brian. It takes, most wrestlers used to tell me when I started, they say, you're going to be 5 to 7 years before you reach where you're going to make money. And that was a scary thing for me because I kept thinking, well, does that mean I'm going to be on the bottom of the card for 5 to 7 years? And there are some guys that take that long. And in my case, I was lucky and I got off that bottom and pretty close to the top of the card within 2 or 3 years. But that's most unusual for that to happen. You see, you thank your after your matches, you thank your opponent. You go and speak to your opponent if you can, if you're not in separate dressing rooms, and you thank him. You thank the referee. And if you run into the promoter, you thank the promoter. Because without him, you don't have that shot. You don't get that chance. You're not on that card. You're not learning to be a wrestler. And you want to wrestle every night. And that leads me to the next thing I used to do all the time. There were times when wrestlers didn't get there. They either were hurt and the promoter didn't know about it, or they were late and they had a problem where they weren't going to be able to get there at all. And they had to go around and say, would somebody take his place? Oh, I was right there. I wanted that to happen. I was eager. If I had a chance to wrestle twice in a night, I loved it. And on occasion, I wrestled 3 times in the night. But I would take 2 people's place if I could, because I wanted that opportunity to be in the ring. You can't learn without it. You cannot become a great wrestler without having the opportunity to be in there and do it on a nightly basis, for it become natural to you. So that was an important part about that as well. And then they had the advice. I always liked to go and speak to my opponent after the match, and I would ask him, you know, what did I do wrong? What can I improve? And how can I get better? And most guys were very great about giving you that critique each night. I thought it was very important. I really looked forward to it. Some guys not so good at critiquing as others, but most guys were willing to give you one or two things that you might be able to do better. And by getting that information, you always managed to make yourself a little bit better the next match. And you had to build from match to match. You wanted your matches to be good. You wanted to have a series of great matches. You'd go out there as a young guy, and sometimes you're going to get lost in that ring. Sometimes you're not going to have that match that you want to have. And you just keep trying to improve. That's the only way to get there and make yourself what you need to be. Another thing I would really that I learned pretty quickly, I never had this problem myself, but I saw guys argue with the booker. Now, the booker is the man, and the booker's responsibility is to decide who's going to wrestle who, decides what's going to happen, what's going to happen on television, what's going to happen in your future. He is in total control of your future in the territory in which you're working. And you don't want to go to him and say, well, I don't like that. You know, especially if you're a young guy. So, you know, and I'm talking about young wrestlers here. I'm trying to be specific about young wrestlers. Now, a veteran, he may have a little more pull with the booker than a young guy, but a young guy doesn't know his butt from a hole in the ground, and he's going to be an idiot if he goes and says to the booker, I don't like that. Can we do something else? That's not going to happen. You're making a huge mistake if you allow that to happen. Another thing that young guys I noticed had a real problem with is they expected to win. They expected to be put over in the early days, in their first 3, 4 months, 6 months, 8 months. And that's been crazy. You're just not being realistic if you think that's going to happen. You go out there and you get beat every night. And you should get beat every night because you have to pay your dues in the sport of wrestling. Back in those days, you had to go in and earn your pay, and earn your position, earn your movement up the card. All of that you had to do by doing what everybody else did that was came before you. They all paid their dues. Anytime you were on a card and you looked at those main eventers, they earned it. They didn't just get slapped there 3 months in. They had to earn their way. And these things, I think people will find the bottom line is respect, respect, respect. Everyone on every level, you respect the referees, you respect the wrestlers, you respect the promoters, you respect those wonderful fans that come and put their hard-earned money down to see you out there and perform. And when you had to have that respect, those guys that came in and they did these things I'm just mentioning, and they developed that constant and committed respect to everybody in the companies, every wrestlers, everybody else. They were the ones that got ahead the fastest.
You mentioned that not every wrestler was good at critiquing matches. Who wasn't good at critiquing matches?
Back when I began, Tony Nero. Tony Nero was a beginner, and he was one of those guys that never made it to the top. That never made it to the main event. So he didn't have the skills that he probably should have had. He did not take care of his body. There's reasons that he didn't get to the top. He didn't take care of his body for one thing. And he wasn't as knowledgeable as other guys. And he never got to be a star. So when you went to talk to him about it, then he was about your match. He was always like, well, you know, it was pretty good. You did all right. Well, what did I do wrong? Well, I don't know anything, but he just never was full of information that you really wanted or needed, which that was kind of disappointing always if you had that kind of result. But that's the one guy that comes off the top of my head. There were a lot of people in the business, a lot of younger guys that were really trying to push to get there too. And they were like me. They wanted, and if you found someone, and I think we talked about this a little bit last week, if you found someone like a Nick Bockwinkel, who was a great star and a great wrestler, a great talent, and you could get him to take an interest in you and critique you on a nightly basis. And Nick did that for me. I don't know. It could have been because my father owned the business at the time. So it could have had something to do with that. And it could be my father went to him and said, would you mind taking a look at my boys, Rob and I, and critiquing them and giving them some insight into how to improve themselves. And Nick was there. I didn't have to go find Nick. Nick would find me. And he would say, Ron, come in here. He would take me into a dressing room privately, never critiqued me in front of anybody else. And he would tell me, I was amazed at how fantastic he was and the little things. And it was always the little things that he talked to me about and showed me that really probably made me get to that spot I was talking about within 2 or 3 years rather than that 5 to 7 years, because he just fine tuned me as a young guy in the first 3 or 4 months that I was in the ring, and I really developed quickly. And my brother developed pretty fast as well, because Nick was giving him a lot of advice too. Nick would not critique the both of us in the dressing room at the same time. He wanted to talk to you by yourself. He wanted to have your full attention, and he did not want anybody else to hear what he was telling you. But he was a great mentor for me. I really never forgot in all my years in the sport, my help from Nick Bockwinkel. And I tell you, in my opinion, that guy could have been world champion for any organization. I don't care what it is, NWA, the WWF, anywhere, anytime in the world. Very few guys had the class and the ability of Nick Bockwinkel.
And as you said earlier, respect was very important. Respect for everyone involved in the wrestling event that you're participating in as a rookie. Did you see a lot of guys who did not have that respect, who were just starting out and for some reason had an attitude and didn't show respect to the referee, the promoter, and anyone else?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I can't think of anybody in particular at this point, but I do remember a lot of young guys, and you would see guys come in and you would know they had an attitude. They wouldn't go and introduce themselves. They just didn't. They didn't have a fit, and they didn't have a concept of what it was going to take to be a star and to make your way in that in the business of being a professional wrestler, and that there were a lot of them that didn't make it. They just didn't make it. And what happened is they weren't there long. They would be there for 2 months, and all of a sudden you would go to towns and you go, well, whatever happened to so and so. And they go, I don't know. And that obviously meant that he got a notice. And he pretty quickly never got anywhere in the sport. And he just got bumped out and cut loose really young in his career.
Well, here we are, though, Ron, in Georgia. And you're starting out. You've explained everything you've gone through, everything you're feeling, everything you're experiencing. You're going from show to show. What's that like?
Oh, that's one of the things. Let's talk a little bit about traveling, the driving your car and tickets. I mean, you're a young guy and you're starting to get paid a little bit. You get a payoff each night. And back in those days, you got paid nightly, in cash. And you had a tendency, as young guys do and young people do that haven't matured yet, and to drive your vehicle fast. And you want to drive fast going there, and you want to drive fast coming home. Well, back in the 70s, in the state of Georgia, there weren't many interstates back in those days, and you spent most of the time on two-lane roads. And there were the biggest speed traps in the state of Georgia. I don't know if it was like that across the entire South, but Georgia in particular seemed like every little town that you drove through, you had to, if they had 25 mile an hour speed limit, you better drive 25. They wouldn't even let you drive 30 sometimes. And I have one story I'd like to tell is about, I went to wrestle in Athens, Georgia. I picked up my cousin, who was younger than me, just a year or so younger than me. He was not a wrestler, just a fan, and he wanted to go and see me wrestle. So I picked him up, and we drove from Locust Grove, Georgia, just south of Atlanta, to Athens, Georgia, the home of the University of Georgia. And we wrestled in Athens. And on the way back from Athens, I was fairly broke. I was a young guy and I wasn't making big money, and I'm driving home that night and we get pulled over by a cop. He's right in the edge of a small town. I do not remember the name of the town, but I know that once he pulled us over, he said, follow me. And he followed him out to the edge of town, and there was a line of cars, about 10 or 12 cars. And he said, pull in behind that car. And he left us sitting there. And it was my first experience with a speed trap. Now, it's probably 11 o'clock at night. And he disappears. He comes back a few minutes later. He puts another car behind us. And a few minutes later, another car behind that car. And then finally, the police come, one car in front, one car behind, and they make everybody follow them down to the courthouse in the little town, whatever the name of the town was. And we go in and sit down, and the judge comes in. And I mean, this is a picture in itself. It's 11 o'clock at night. He's got on one of those long gowns like you used to see people sleep with back in the 30s or 40s or whatever, and the little hat that has the little ball on it, that, you know, it was almost like a joke. When I saw him come in the courtroom, he sits down, he gets the gavel, bang, bang, he lands on the deal, and we're going to start talking to these people. What's the deal? He had the policeman come up. So we're at the bottom, back of the line. So we're going to wait and watch everybody go through this process. He brings up one person at a time, one speeder at a time. The policeman says, "Hey, Your Honor, he was going 35 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone." Bang, bang. The judge was just no speak. And they didn't ask, "Do you want to talk? You got anything to say?" Bang, bang. "That'll be $50, whatever the fine was. And so the person would then move off to the side, go over there, and you can handle it with such and such. Next one, they bring the next guy. So we watched me and my cousin. We watched this process for it probably 45 minutes. Him deciding what the fines are going to be and the people paying for their fine. And then it's my turn. And my cousin gets out of his chair and he goes up there with me. Which probably I don't think he was supposed to, but, you know, we're young guys. And my first experience at one of these deals, and the judge bang, bang on his gavel, and he goes, "What's the deal?" And the cop says, "Hey, he's doing 35 to 25, whatever it was." And he says, "That'll be $60. Bang, bang. He just on the gavel again. And so I don't have $60. There's no credit cards. You know, it's not credit card times, and, you know, there's no credit card or anything like that, and I didn't bring any extra money. That night, I didn't get paid. They paid me that particular town. They paid off later on it. So I say, I don't have it. I thumbed through my pocket. I knew I didn't have it. So I said, you know, I don't have it, Your Honor. And he goes, "You don't have the money?" I goes, "No, I don't." He said, "You spend a night in the jail." Bang, bang. So I go, and my cousin, so I don't say anything, but he goes, as soon as he says, "You spend a night in jail," bang, bang, and he hits his gavel. My cousin goes, "Oh, no, 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 Your Honor, no, no, please, please, listen, you know," he starts, you know, trying to bail me out, basically. Let's do something here. So the judge says, to my cousin, he goes, "Well, how much money do you have?" And he pulls his money out. He had like $15. He said, "I got $15, Your Honor," or whatever it was. And the judge says, "That's not enough." And so the judge looks back to me again. He goes, "How much money do you have?" And I say, "Well, I pull out what I got. We got a total of maybe $28 or whatever it is." And I say 13, and he adds it up in his head. "And that's $28. No, you spend a night in the jail." Bang, bang. He gavels again. And my cousin again, he goes, "No, no, no, Your Honor, please. No, 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 please don't put us in jail. No, no, no." You know, so he's like, now he's a little bit perturbed, you know, like, "Geez, what are we going to have to do here?" So finally, I say, "Your Honor, would you be willing to accept every penny we got here, basically? It's at $28 or whatever it is, and let us go home." And he could tell he was upset about the whole deal. And then finally he says, banged on his gavel. He said, "Okay, give me your money. Just pay the man over there." And so they released us. So I had my experience with the police, right? It was a bad experience. I think I wasn't the only one. There was probably 10 or 12 others that experienced it that night. And I don't believe across the state of Georgia back during those days, no telling how many people received these fines and went through the same process that I went through.
Well, Ron, before we pick up the story, let's go to a little announcement right here that we have, a very special one about the next Super Studcast.
The Tennessee Stud has set the podcast world ablaze with his unique concept of an honest and insightful deep dive into wrestling history. With his Andre the Giant and Ron Wright Super Studcast, he began with one giant of the sport and followed with the introduction of another, less well-known but just as interesting. In Super Studcast 3, he moves from personalities to places on our planet. The Caribbean is a magnificently beautiful chain of islands and countries stretching thousands of miles off the southeastern coast of North America. Some living within this paradise have always been known for strange rituals and cultures, and the Stud personally believes that this is one reason why this forbidden zone is known as the Devil's Triangle. Super Studcast number 3 will take you inside the Devil's Triangle and expose you to a wrestling world as unimaginable and alien as anywhere on the planet. Get ready to be astonished and amazed by what you hear. It can only be appropriately described by one who has experienced it and just happens to be one of the greatest storytellers of all time, your Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. This is why they call these two-hour experiences Super Studcast. Now, sit back, prop up your feet, close your eyes, and imagine the breeze rustling through the palm fronds as we begin the ride 90 miles off the beaches of Miami in Nassau, Bahamas. This is Super Studcast number 3.
Well, there we go. The announcement, the next Super Studcast, very exciting news, wrestling in the Bahamas and third world countries. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later on in the show, but let's pick up from where we left off, Ron. You had to deal with a lot of speed traps. You had to deal with a lot of police in Georgia.
Yes. And another time, this is my last little story about the police here, but another time, there was a little stretch of freeway. Back in the early days, there's a freeway that runs from I-75, basically in Macon, across the state to Savannah, which is a long trip from Atlanta to Savannah. For folks that don't know, that's an extensive trip. That's a 4 or 5 hour trip. And there was a little patches of freeway, about 10 miles, and then you'd have to get off the freeway, back on a two-lane road, drive another 30 miles. Then you would put you back on a little small finished stretch of the freeway. This is Interstate 16, back in 1970. So I'm on a little stretch of the freeway, and it's me by myself, and I'm hustling to get there because I want to get there a little bit early. I'm not paying attention. I'm a young guy and just kind of, once you get on that freeway, you want to hit the gas and you want to open it up. Now, there's very few people on the road. It's not like crowded freeways that we have today. There's not a lot of people on that freeway. And I get on the little stretch of freeway and I'm rolling along. I'm not even paying attention to how fast I'm going. And I look in my rearview mirror and there's a highway patrolman on my bumper so close that I can't tap my brakes. Yeah, I think he's like drafting me in a NASCAR race. He's that close. And I look down at my speedometer and I'm doing 105. And I go, oh my gosh, I'm just distraught. Like, oh geez. And he's so close on my bumper, I can't touch my brakes. So I just have to get my foot off the gas and I start watching that speedometer and it's 105, 104, 103. It's like, oh my gosh. And he's just staying right there and he waits until I get down to 70 or 65, the speed limit, whatever the speed limit was. It seemed like an eternity. Never turns his lights on. I'm thinking, anytime, here it comes, here it comes, here it comes, the big ticket. And he gets me down. He follows me and tailgates me till I'm down to 65. And he whips out beside me and whips right up straight in the left-hand lane. And he looks over at me. And I don't even want to look. You know, I'm like, hey, I know he's just waiting on me to look over so he can turn the lights on. I mean, he's just driving me crazy. This guy's killing me here. And finally, I look over at him, and he takes his finger and he wags it at me like, no, no, no. And then he takes off. And I'm like, oh, thank you, sir, so much. I was going to probably go to Savannah and make $25, $30, and it was going to cost me $50 or $100 for the ticket. I was like, oh, gosh, my week is gone. I'm not going to make anything this week. So you had to be careful back in those days. Georgia was a bad state. It was a really bad state for traffic tickets, for those little speed traps through the smaller towns. And it was a different day and time. And they knew how to get you, and they got you. They really made their money a lot of times on poor people that were speeding. Let's change gears here a little bit, Brian. I want to talk about my dad a little bit. Now we it's been a while since I spoke about my dad. I've went through a lot of episodes, and my dad was a pretty smart businessman that did great not only in wrestling, but he also did great in his real estate developments. He was all the time buying farms and property. And he had property on three different parts of Atlanta in about 1970, in this same time frame, in which there was an announcement in the Atlanta paper that they were going to build a new Atlanta airport. And they put picture, a map in there, and they showed three possible places that the new airport was going to be built. And when he woke me up, or I got up and saw the Sunday paper laying there, I looked at it and I went, geez, Dad's got land and in three of those places, right, with, you know, within miles or of where they're talking about building a new airport. So, you know, he's like, well, you know, looks like I'm in pretty good shape here. You know, I'm building an airport. It's probably going to be I'll make some money off of one of these three. So I'm like, wow, you know. Then he goes, but I don't think I'm going to want to sell. And I was like, geez, I could not figure it. Why would you not sell it? And then he found out that two days or the next week, probably 2 weeks later, they made the announcement that they decided not to take any of those locations. They were going to expand the existing airport, which is still there, Hartsfield Field. I believe that's what it is, correct? I think, Brian, you're very familiar with that, no doubt.
I'm not familiar with Hartsfield Field, no.
So it's, you know, it's a huge airport now. Gosh, one of the biggest in the world. I mean, it's a monster. So, but what they did then is they decide now they're not going to do it. So in the meantime, in that 2 weeks period of time, he changed his mind and he said, and a lot of speculators saw the same map and they come running out there and found his property and said, you know, we won't buy it because if they build an airport here, geez, this is going to be it's going to be worth a lot of money. So he sells all three of them. He sells all the land and all three of those locations that's prospective for this airport. And then they announced that they're going to expand the original airport. He's already sold the deals. He cut the deals and he's already gotten his money. Then he goes to, down there by the big airport there were neighborhoods right in the vicinity of the airport. And those people in those neighborhoods, they confiscated their homes. They say, we're going to take your house. They bought it for a small amount of money, whatever it was. And sure, they probably basically stole their houses from them. And they were going to tear those houses down. Well, Dad finds out where they're going to, what he can buy those houses for. So he decides that he's going to go in there. He buys up about 30 houses that are within this confiscated area to expand the airport. And he has a big farm in Locust Grove, Georgia. And he decides he's going to move those houses 30 miles. He couldn't take them down the freeway. He took them down the old highway between out there through McDonough, Georgia, into Locust Grove. And he set them up on his property and he sold houses to people that couldn't afford a house, that never could have bought a house. He went in, he redid the floors. And my brother and I worked on these houses. We redid the floors, we did the roofs and everything. We went in and made it nice and practically new for the buyers. And then the buyers were people that couldn't afford it. And he financed the houses for those buyers. So Nene not only got them homes, but he gave them hope, which, you know, I really admired him for the fact that, you know, he could have waited until he got somebody that had the money and gotten his money. But he sold a great number of those homes to people that made a very small down payment, worked out an arrangement with him to pay him over a great number of years. And it was really a nice thing for him to do. Dad was really good about that, had a big heart. And that was one of those deals that, you know, he'd made money off of the property that he sold, anticipating the airport was going there. And I think he kind of gave back in that respect to others. And a nice thing for Dad, because he was a big hearted guy. And the last thing I want to do here, Brian, today is I want to talk about Rob and I. Now, we've been here in Georgia for 3-4 months, our first 3 or 4 months in wrestling. And we've beaten Chotty and Fuji and some of the other pretty darn good teams there. We've worked pretty good as a tag team together. we've been trained a lot, and we have the benefit of being wrestlers' sons. But at the same time, we have earned a shot with the Assassins. They're the Georgia Tag Team Champions. Now, we're young guys. It's obvious to people that watch us and they see us in the ring that we are very young and we're green. The Assassins are a fabulous team. I mean, that's Tom Renesto and Jody Hamilton. Really great workers. And we work a program with them for about 4 weeks around the entire state of Georgia, in which they used to load their hoods. They had a way of winning most of their matches. And when they really got in trouble, they were identical. You couldn't tell one from the other. And they would, one guy would go out of the ring. The other guy would come back in. The referee wouldn't see it. He would be fresh. The guy that's in the ring is not fresh. The opponent's not fresh. He would figure out how to get his, how to load his mask, and he would headbutt you. And it would it happened to me. It happened to my brother. We both went through it. We got headbutted several times and pretty much knock you about unconscious. I mean, those guys had a hard head, and when they, whatever they had in there, it just made for a bad experience for you when you got it from them. So my dad came on television, took us on television, and he said, you know, my boys are young, and he said, I think they're pretty good, but they're really not getting a chance because of the way the Assassins are loading their masks. It's the same things they've been doing for years. And he goes, it's not illegal to wear headgear in wrestling. He goes, so we've got a match signed for them with the Assassins for the Georgia title. And I want them to wear amateur wrestling headgear. And it's a pretty good idea because obviously they load the mask and they're going to headbutt you with that big padding of
yeah.
The, you're not going to be able to knock somebody out through that thick padding. So it was, and the Assassins came out. They weren't aware of this, and they, you know, they knew we had a championship match, but they didn't know it was going to be with some kind of headgear on. So they were pretty hot about it. So we wrestled around the state as after only 3 or 4 months and as actual wrestlers and as a team, having a shot at the champions. And on two occasions, we almost won the championship twice, once in Augusta, once in Atlanta. Didn't win, but it was a great experience for us. We got that opportunity to test ourselves against two of the very best there was out there. And anytime you had the opportunity to wrestle wrestlers that had that kind of talent, you always left the ring a better wrestler than you were when you went in. You learned something through that experience. And in the case of those guys, you learned a lot of things through that experience because they were just that good.
We've seen the picture of you playing basketball in Miami, Ron, and I've seen pictures of you at this time starting out in Georgia and, of course, in Florida. And the big question is, looking back now, are you happy with or do you regret your mustache?
Oh, I'm happy with it. Now, you know, you got to think, Brian, this is 1970. Now, we're in the 1960s are hippie days. It's days when people had long hair. And not just the mustache I had, but I had long hair, and most guys had long hair back in those days. I was a young, new generation. I wanted to be different. And so I grew myself a mustache. As the time went on in the next 3 years, early 70s, 71, 72, 73, in that time frame, that regular mustache becomes a Fu Manchu. It gets a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Hair gets a little bit longer and bushier. And, you know, I wanted to be different. So at the same time, I would make these little beads on a string, a stretchy type of string, and fill them with beads and tie those together. And every night I put this necklace on and I would wear it out there to be introduced. And then I would take it off and fling it into the crowd. You know, today, by today's standards, is probably ridiculously no one would do it anymore. But this was 1970. Things were different. It was a different day and time. And I guess probably I was just like a lot of other people at that time, trying to find myself, to who the heck am I really, you know, and to be different than the establishment. And my dad probably had the same thought as you, I believe. And he probably said to me many times, what are you doing, man? You know, and I would say, hey, you know, I can be like everybody else. Rob, if you see the pictures of Rob in that same time frame, and I'm probably going to use one of those on the gallery on my website. I put a picture for every episode, and I'll probably find another picture, early 70s, of Rob and I. And he's all clean shaven. Looks like a nice young boy from anywhere in America. And then I got that long hair and the mustache. I'm quite a bit different than Rob. And part of that, I think, had to do, Brian, with coming out of the University of Miami at a really bad time. I was there for Kent State when the Vietnam War was a contentious matter for our country. And a lot of things were going on all across the country between the younger generation and the older generation, and is that war worth fighting, and so many questions. And then right at the end of my last year at the University of Miami, they had that Kent State incident in which students got shot by the National Guardsmen or whatever it was, and they basically that year closed down campuses. They did not finish your year. Instead of finishing your year as everybody had done traditionally forever, it may be the only time in American history in which students were sent home without actually finishing their year. And part of it, you know, I think I'm kind of proud to have been a part of that time frame and to be in college during all of that stuff. And so I was a little bit as a rebellious guy, and I wanted to have a look of my own, and that mustache kind of gave it to me. Now, as time goes on here, and I'm going to get to 1974 or so, and I'm going to decide to become a promoter, and I'm going to buy my first business, I could not have done it. I was a babyface for all those years. Fans love me. And when I went to Knoxville, when I'm going to go to Knoxville, I'm going to turn into the baddest, most hated, probably heel in the history of Tennessee. And I'm going to do it with that long hair and that same Fu Manchu. And I will need that mustache. I didn't need it back in those days, but I will need it then to accomplish what I'm going to accomplish in Knoxville and Southeastern wrestling once it starts.
Wrestling always had guys with longer hair. There was Baron Michele Leone. I mean, you know, Mario Galento very well. There were always guys that had that look, but when you were breaking in, it was really more associated with youth culture and everything that was happening on campuses and with the youth in the country. So when someone like you or another wrestler who's younger walks into the locker room and you have longer hair and you have facial hair, do any of the old timers make snide remarks? Are any of them mad that this is the way you look?
I like that. You know, one thing, Brian, I'm 6'9", and I weigh about 260 pounds.
Good point.
You know, I come from a wrestling family. They don't know whether I know how to shoot or not, you know, so they're a little hesitant to go making fun of me right off the bat until they kind of get to know me, you know. So I have a look about me that people hesitate to give me any crap much, you know. They don't want to really get on my bad side right away. So I never got a whole lot of that. You know, I think guys, wrestlers are pretty much, they're really broad-minded individuals because they see everything. They've been around every type of person. They're worldly by all standards. And, you know, they see things differently. And I don't think I ever had anybody said, boy, your hair looks like crap. Or, you know, what do you got that mustache for? It was just, I was tolerated, maybe because of my size, maybe because of my family or whatever it is. But I never got any of that.
Okay, I'm sure Mike Boyette had a much different treatment when he walked in the locker room than you did, for instance.
Oh, yes, he did. And I was in Florida with him. I'm going to be in Florida with Mike Boyette, and Hippie Boyette was quite a different. He got a lot of that.
Yeah.
He got a whole lot of that stuff you're talking about, and I think eventually it forced him to leave. Basically, it kind of pushed him out of there because he was so different than most guys that it made it difficult for him to get over there. Florida's a unique territory, and since we're talking about it, we're about to leave Georgia here, and I think next episode we're going to move from Georgia to Florida. I'm going to start into the territory that I call the territory for me. It's where I really learn my skills. It's where I become Ron Fuller and start to be a name rather than just a body on the card. And we're going to talk Snake Pit, and we're going to talk all kinds of things that are going to be a part of Florida. Just the Bahamas, basically. That's going to be a part of that. And I've got this super stud cast that is going to really highlight that phenomenal and absolutely crazy experience of wrestling in some of those countries in the Caribbean.
A lot of people are looking forward to that. A lot of people are looking forward to hearing you finally get to Florida, and we'll tell everyone a little bit more about that at the end of the show. But now, before we go, Ron, we have a few questions from the listeners, and this time I promise we will pick a winner before the show goes off the air. And question one is from Justin Matthews in Broken Hill, New South Wales, Australia. We have a lot of international listeners, I've noticed here. And the question is, were you and your dad looking to buy Australia in 1973. I've heard various things about this too, Ron, that your father, and I've heard him and Eddie Graham maybe, were actually looking, when Jim Barnett was looking to sell, they were looking at potentially going over there. What's the real story?
Okay, that's a great question. And I think why, you know, and I kind of like you, Brian, I see a lot of people and a lot of comments. I have a lot of fans in Australia because I spent 3 months there in 1973, and I was a pretty good star. I was becoming a pretty darn good wrestler at that point. And I think that's why I have fans there. And 73 is the year I was there. This is a very knowledgeable fan. People may not know this. Jim Barnett was owned Australia. He built that country into a wrestling empire. It was huge. And he and my father were excellent friends. And in the early 70s, they got closer and closer. And in 1973, Jim was somewhat growing tired of Australia. And he offered my dad a partnership with him in Australia in 73, and dad took that opportunity. I was one of the wrestlers that went in that crew, that first crew of Barnett's and dad's, and they were partners. And they had, Australia is a unique example of Georgia. We've talked about having two promoters. Australia, you had a continent. You owned everything. It's kind of like where Vince McMahon Jr. is today. You owned it all, and Vince owned it all. He owned the whole, I mean, not Vince, but Jim Barnett. He owned that country, and you wrestled everywhere when you wrestled in Australia. It was a strange experience. Australia was a fabulous country. I can't wait to get to the Australia days. It's one of my most favorite places I've ever been. I have a story real quickly. My dad was crazy. He was out there, way out there, wanting to do crazy things. And one day we're in Australia, and I had no interest in it. To answer the gentleman's question, I didn't want to be a promoter, and I certainly didn't want to be a promoter in Australia. It's going to be a year later, I am going to be a promoter. I'm going to find myself in that position. But dad doesn't take that Australia opportunity either. But dad, one Sunday morning, slides a newspaper across to me. We're in Sydney. And he says, look at that article right there. He says, where is the York Peninsula? Well, the York Peninsula in Australia is in the northern, northeastern part of the country. And it is, the further you go north, it's on the opposite side of the earth, obviously, the equator. So the further north you go, the hotter it gets. And the York Peninsula, I knew a little bit about the York Peninsula. And I said, Dad, there's crocodiles and they have monsoon seasons. I mean, you're not far from the equator. It's hot. He goes, look at that, though. He goes, you can buy, he says, there's 1 million acres for sale in the York Peninsula for 25 cents an acre.
Wow.
I was like, yeah, and so what? He goes, well, if we bought a place up there, he says, we could think about it. You got 1 million acres. I said, come on. You know? So my dad was pretty far out there. You know, he saw things from a different perspective. Obviously we never embarked on that little journey either, but yes, we were in Australia together. I was there. I was with my dad. Jim Barnett ran that company. I was there for 3 months. I was there with stars like Austin Idol, pre-Austin Idol, Dennis McCourt. I was there with Spyros Arion from Greece and Mario Milano from Italy and Sabu Singh from India.
Mark Lewin,
King Curtis. Yeah. King Curtis Aika. I mean, Georgia Animal Steel. I mean, it just went on and on and on. Talent from all over the world. It was a fantastic and phenomenal place to work. It was so good, Brian, that in the 3 months that I went there, I was never considered to be a top guy. When I went back to Florida, I was right to the top because I honed my skills in that 3 months in Australia. I had an opportunity to wrestle such a varied group of talent. It was phenomenal. And I went home to America and became a star. And I attribute that to the Australian trip. I kind of give credit to that trip to Australia. It changed everything for me.
And I'm sure you also went home with a really good tan, if I had to guess.
Oh, a fabulous tan. I went to the beach every single day. Another guy in that crew went with me every day. Now, you talk about lighting up beaches and having people stare at you. It was me and Little Tokyo the Midget. And Tokyo went with me every day to the beach, and we body surfed together. And we walked down those beaches, and people's heads turned. It was like, what is this? You know, you got the little Japanese midget and this big, huge American, you know. So it was a real experience. I really enjoyed my Australian days.
Well, Australia will be a topic we discuss here on the program as we get to when you were actually there in 73. And I could say the same thing about this next topic. But this next question is from Michael Christopher McKay in Los Angeles, California. How hard is it running a territory, but wrestling in a different territory at the same time? For example, Georgia in 1972.
It's big time difficult. When you own a business, a wrestling company, and I find this out through an experience that we will talk about later on, the split that happened with Southeastern Wrestling, my first wrestling company, you need to be there. You need to be there and you need to see what's happening in your company. You need to be on top of things. And I had the feeling that I was a good enough athlete, that my territory was going very, very well. It had a great reputation and I was getting some super talent in there. They were rocking it for me. I didn't have to be on those cards to sell out buildings and to sell out arenas. So I said, well, you know, this is actually, I think it's probably 82 maybe rather than 72. It's when Georgia Championship was getting involved with Turner and it was beginning to be the satellite production. It was beginning to have a worldwide scope because of that satellite. And I said, you know, I want to get on there. I need to keep myself relevant worldwide, because I've been to Japan, I'd been to Australia, and I'd been in the Caribbean, and I'd been a lot of different countries and wrestled to Canada and everywhere. And I needed that relevancy still, I thought. And it was difficult for me. I did not have a problem in that year. But I'm going to have a problem by doing that as time goes by. When I get that second Southeastern Wrestling cranked up that runs out of Pensacola, and I've got one in Knoxville and one in Pensacola, and I'm not able to be both places at one time, it's going to cause me a big problem as years go by and in the future.
But in this case, in 1972 in Georgia, although it didn't affect you that same way, by this point, your father had sold his interest in Georgia. He's now partners in Florida. And after everything that goes down in 72, and we'll obviously talk about that here on the program, your father's coming up to Atlanta for shows. You and Robert are coming up for shows. Eddie Graham's coming up for shows. Florida really, more than the entire NWA, obviously, because of location and also the relationship between the two offices, Florida really picked up the slack.
Yes. Florida was loaded with talent. Florida had tremendous talent, and they were sending Briscoe, as an example. They were sending Jack to St. Louis, and Jack was a huge star. Jack Briscoe was a huge star in Florida. So when you can take a top guy like that and you can send him out on the weekends, and you got guys that you can send to Atlanta on a Friday night that you don't need in Florida, it says a lot about that rockin' Florida. And that's what we're going to start talking about next week, is we're going to talk about that rockin' Florida. Florida becomes, Gordon Solie I think, the greatest commentator maybe ever. They've got everything going for them. They've got smart people that own that company. My dad's involved. Eddie Graham's involved. You've got Barnett up there in that, you know, it's going to be in that area there. It's a swap of talent, and it's a mesh of ownerships between very close territories in proximity that are not only close in proximity, they're close with their owners. And it's a strong element going there at that time frame, extremely strong element. And I was lucky to be a part of it. I'm in that Florida crew. I'm making those Atlanta trips. I'm having the opportunity to wrestle there. Come 73, I'm going to be heading off to St. Louis a lot and wrestling in St. Louis, which is one of the key cities to become a national star. So things are happening for me, and that's a great question. Both of those questions today, Brian, are super questions.
Well, now pick a winner. There's the problem.
Yeah, that's pretty difficult. It's pretty difficult. You know, I'm very fond of Australia, but at the same time, I believe the second question, you know, about trying to run a business and trying to be both an owner and a wrestler. And if you're doing it in your own business, that's one thing. But when you're doing it, you're an owner here and you're wrestling there, that becomes a problem for me. And I'm going to have to go with the second gentleman, the gentleman from Los Angeles. I'm going to have to say that I really think that's probably the question of the day.
Our winner, Michael Christopher McKay in Los Angeles, California. Congratulations. And the stud will be getting in touch with you soon. But as we begin to wrap things up, a few notes here. Once again, we want to tell you about how you can stay in touch with the show on social media. You can follow the stud on Instagram or Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. And you can also follow him on Facebook at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. And you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. The next Super Studcast is coming at you on Sunday, March 11th, 2018. We said it before. This is one a lot of people are waiting for. Wrestling in the Bahamas and third world countries. I can't wait to hear it, and I know everyone else is waiting too. Once again, Sunday, March 11th, 2018. It's only $2.99 to access this show, as well as the other Super Studcast on Andre the Giant and Ron Wright, and the rest of the story where Ron Fuller answers your questions about those subjects. Go to patreon.com/studcast to access the Super Studcast and the rest of the story. The Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.